Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Welcome to the new reality edition of Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, where we serve you the first bite of today's science, technology, and innovation. I'm Bert Lum, and first up, let's welcome back The Catalyst by Lemomi Bong. In this segment, she talks about the Hawaii Conservation Conference.
This is The Catalyst brought to you by Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum. My name is Lemomi, and here is your weekly Tech Bite. The Hawaii Conservation Conference is coming up in July. This year's theme is Imi Ike Ewe Oka'aina, may we be guided by the wisdom of the land. Across 3 days, researchers, cultural practitioners, students, and community members will gather around Hawaii's urgent questions: climate change, restoration, invasive species, and the future of native ecosystems. One conversation making national headlines is biocontrol. Through the Birds, Not Mosquitoes initiative, conservation partners on Maui and Kauai are releasing Wolbachia-treated male mosquitoes to help protect native honeycreepers from avian malaria. These males don't bite, and when they mate with wild females, the eggs don't hatch. It is careful work moving through science, public policy, and community concern. Recently, Alphabet's D-Bug project is seeking approval to release treated mosquitoes in California and Florida, aimed at reducing dengue and Zika in humans. When a company like Google enters this field, the question shifts a bit. Is it scaling a public health tool, a data system, or a new kind of environmental decision-making? As temperatures rise and ecosystems change, more places are facing challenges islands have been navigating for generations. What looks like conservation in Hawaii is also innovation, sustainable, place-based, and increasingly relevant to the rest of the world. That's what I'll be listening for at ConCon. For more info, visit hawaiiconservation.org.
Mahalo, Lemomi. And of course, on today's show, we'll catch up with Brooke Connor. He's a faculty member over at UH Manoa and former CIO, Chief Information Officer at the Hawaii Department of Education, and a current PhD candidate. Hey, Brooke, welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe.
Hey, Bert. It is great to be back talking to you. Always fun talking about all sorts of just exciting things going on in the world.
Well, you know, Brooke, you were a pretty regular on our Broadband Hui, and you know, that was sort of during the pandemic, and of course there was a lot of stuff going on in terms of stay-at-home orders and how do you get technology to students when, you know, they're pretty much stuck at home, and it could be an issue of they may not have internet or they may not have a computer at home. So, you know, there was a lot of activity, and I know, Brooke, you were one of the people that we relied on quite a bit to kind of help, sort of chart that path that was kind of unknown until the pandemic proved that there was a big kind of gap out there.
Yep. It may have been me trying to find the landmarks where we should be going, but I mean, I had a huge team that did a huge amount of work, and all the schools worked incredibly hard. But they couldn't have done that without a foundation of technology, and that was my team providing the technology that enabled all of that remote access. In the course of 1 week, the department went from we'd have a dozen, two dozen video conferences a week to tens of thousands a day.
And I remember,
you know, we had the infrastructure to do that, and that was part of a digital transformation for the department that they almost didn't even realize that they needed. I mean, they knew they needed something better. They knew they needed improvements, but nobody could have predicted before COVID we're going to need this kind of stuff.
And, oh yeah,
and yet there we were. It was tough. You know, the schools had a hard time. But I think they would have had a much harder time if that technology hadn't been in place.
Well, and you know, credit to you and your team and the foresight of at least having some of that infrastructure in place. And I do remember prior to the pandemic, Zoom was around. Not everybody, you know, was using it. I mean, everybody was kind of at that point in time. I remember it's like early 2020, late 2019. People were like, I don't want to show my face on a video conference. You know, why would I want to do that? And then, of course, as soon as the pandemic kind of forced everybody to stay at home, I know in the business community, a lot of meetings did rely on Zoom. But then as classes needed to be delivered remotely, I remember how in terms of the administration trying to figure out, okay, do we deliver this kind of course material online, or do we have them come and pick up, you know, the lesson of the day and then take it home and, you know, and try to work through it in that sort of physical space. And I can see where the challenges were, because, you know, when you go from teaching a class and all the students are in the class, and all of a sudden, you know, this sort of pandemic forces you to figure out, like, how do I actually teach this class remotely? That's not an easy thing to do.
No, it's a big shift, and you need to be flexible, both the people doing the instruction, the students, but also the people supporting the technology to enable that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we absolutely had some schools that said, no, the way that we're going to do it is our students are going to come and pick up paper packets, because that's what we're ready to do.
Mm-hmm.
There were other schools that said, we are already one-to-one. Every student has a device through the school. We're ready to just really move ahead with technology. But we also had families that said, I don't want my kids on screens all day. So I don't care what you're doing at this school. We need a paper packet for our school, for our Ohana, because that's what's right for us. So everybody had to be flexible and adaptive and use all sorts of different technologies. And my team just did heroic work making so many different technologies available. You know, everybody says, oh, yes, Zoom was the easy, obvious answer, but it's not actually that easy when you're trying to do it for 250,000 students while abiding by procurement rules and transparency for state government and making sure that everything is done correctly and that you're not getting the schools into some sort of legal hot water by signing a contract that they can't actually sign because it's against the law. And all that stuff that went on behind the scenes, and still the team made it happen and made all sorts of other technologies available too. The whole Google for Education environment. We had WebEx as well. We had Google Meet. So whatever the schools were comfortable with, we said, these are the tools that are available, and we're here to help you be successful at the core mission, which is teaching the kids.
Well, you're absolutely right, you know, in describing it as, you know, a heroic effort, because, you know, given the time frame and the technology and the fact, like you just said, you had 250,000 students all having to deal with some form of remote lessons. I think what you guys did was quite heroic, and you know, I don't know if that is appreciated, but you know, I think that was. I do have a sense of what you must have gone through, and I do agree that was a monumental and heroic task. So hats off to you.
Thank you, and I know that there are some people out there, because I'll run into them. I'll run into somebody that was a teacher at that time during that challenging period. And then they talking to me, and they're like, wait, that's why I know your name. Your name was on the memo making Google available to all the schools when we had Lotus Notes before. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So I know that there are people out there that just really recognize that this was so helpful.
Yeah.
In that time.
And I think the benefits of it are seen, you know, today, 2026. But I do want to talk to you a little bit about, well, as we transition into the next phase of your chapters, you know, when you left as a CIO, there's probably a world of opportunity that you could have chose to go down. And I did want to chat with you a little bit about the decision to go down the academic path, which is kind of very interesting in and of itself. So we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back with a short break to continue our conversation with Brooke Connor, faculty member over at UH Manoa and former CIO over at the Hawaii Department of Education. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR 1. I'm Bert Lum. And if you're just joining us, we're catching up with Brooke Connor. He's a faculty member over at UH Manoa, former CIO over at the Department of Education, and currently a PhD candidate focusing on digital transformation. And Brooke, I know you probably have a lot to talk about in terms of digital transformation, but before we get to that, I'm kind of curious, like, what did you think about once you decided, okay, I'm moving on from CIO? Speaking personally, I would think that you would have chased down another CIO type of position, but I think it's quite unique for you to decide, I'm going to go the academic route and actually get, go into the PhD program. So, mm-hmm. I want to hear what your sort of story behind that decision is.
So, in some sense, it's almost coming home. It's returning to something that I did 30 years ago, because I got my start in a career as an academic, publishing research papers in the 90s on interactive 3D graphics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I started working on a PhD at that point, but life happened. I ended up moving over to the corporate world. I also got a divorce. Like I said, life happened. And I started working at large companies that were trying to deal with changes in technology.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the 90s, I went to work for Sony Corporation that was trying to figure out what the World Wide Web was and how they were going to use it back when that was brand new. I went to Bloomberg that was using information systems and data and knowledge to help financial experts make more informed decisions. I worked in cybersecurity at Morgan Stanley. I became the head of cybersecurity at Estee Lauder Companies, a Fortune 500 retailer and manufacturer. And then I went to be the CIO at Haido.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, I realized, you know, I've accomplished some really amazing things. Any CIO would be proud of any one of the half a dozen digital transformations that my team and I were able to accomplish at the Department of Ed. And I needed to figure out how can I share some of that experience.
Mm-hmm, right.
30 years of adapting to new technology successfully. And my new wife said, you know, you always wanted to get that PhD. Why don't you do that? And that was like a light bulb. Mm-hmm. First of all, it was a huge amount of support from her, from my Ohana. My daughter is just looking forward to the day where she can say, hey, Dr. Dad. So,
yeah.
You know, now I can take all that experience and start publishing that information, sharing those ideas, thinking about all the new technologies that people are trying to grapple with today, whether it's virtual reality, which came back after a couple of decades in the wilderness, to, of course, AI and large language models and everything people are talking about there. Quantum computing is starting to bubble up on the edges as something that people really need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of new technologies and changes. And now, so I want to help people figure out what to do with it.
Yeah. And I can see where your path has afforded you a lot of firsthand experience. And I can mm-hmm. relate to the desire to want to put that, you know, in some form of, let's say, black and white. And, you know, it could be mm-hmm. in a form of a research paper. It could be in a form of a dissertation. It could be a form of something,
sure.
You know, that gets published. And interestingly, you know, last week I had Gordon Bruce on, and his thing, you know, at this point is more in the private sector, but, you know, publishing a book and actually putting down some thoughts on where cybersecurity is going. Now, in your case, what I also found quite exciting and an intersection in terms of, you know, where I'm constantly sort of exposed to being sort of in telecom and the internet and broadband was the fact that you had had presented a paper over at PTC. And I get to go to PTC, and PTC is the Pacific Telecommunications Council convening of, it's like the big conference for anybody that's interested in broadband and internet and data centers and all the stuff that basically is the foundation upon which, you know, our digital society lives on, right? And to see you there providing a paper was a great sort of feeling of intersection between you and the work that you're doing in academia, as well as the commercial world that is you know, sort of pushing this technology that has been around for quite a long time, but it is also quickly changing. Maybe spend a few, you know, just a few minutes here talking about, you know, your paper and it was entitled, and it was quite provocative. It was The Cult of the Big Slop, and it was really about AI and what your kind of literature research sort of indicated where things are going in terms of AI. Now, this is back in January, so, you know, we're a good good 7 months away from that, and I'm sure you can say a lot has changed since then. But as a highlight, what would you say you were presenting at PTC?
Well, so at PTC, we were talking about, and I say we because my wife was actually the co-author on this paper. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I love about the PhD program, and it's so interdisciplinary. You know, my wife and I sit around and talk about this stuff for fun. So this is just like tremendous fun for both of us. But it's this idea that the people, and we were writing this paper last summer, a year ago, and we noticed language in the way people were talking about AI that was following the same constructs that people talk about when they're running a cult.
Mm.
They give you something that you just can't argue with, for example, a thought-terminating cliche. Well, you don't like AI? AI is inevitable. Where do you take the discussion from that? There's no place to go from there. You don't like my God and my cult? Well, my God is inevitable.
I can see
some real parallels there.
Yeah, yeah. I can see where that is a thought-ending cliche.
Exactly. And so when we started looking at that and started seeing what people were starting to do with generative AI, they were creating what even a year ago people were starting to call slop. And so we hypothesized that, wait a minute, if people are cultishly piling onto this big pile of slop, I've worked on Wall Street. This feels familiar. This feels like a bubble. And so we thought that last summer. By the time the paper was presented at PTC, the press was talking about, oh my gosh, valuations of AI companies are so high, and maybe this is a bubble. And now at this point, that's still what's going on. People are talking about the circular financing of AI companies and chip companies and data center companies. And, you know, oh, I'll give you an investment in your company as long as you agree to buy my stuff. And that's like this shell game kind of, where's the money going? Is it really there? Does it really exist? That is extremely concerning. But the way that you come at figuring that out and recognizing that is interdisciplinary. You need to understand something about how this AI technology works, how data centers work, how networks work. But you also need to understand something about how people work and how people talk about systems of control and how they influence that. And so that paper, was really working through some of those challenges, and continues to kind of show that, wait a minute, there's a lot of stuff going on here.
Yeah. So Brooke, I do want to give you a chance to maybe extrapolate what you think might happen. The bubble hasn't burst yet, so we're 7 months, post your paper in January. So I do want to give you a chance to talk about what you think might happen. But we'll hold that thought. We'll be right back at this short break to continue our conversation with Brooke Connor, faculty over at UH Manoa and former CIO over at the Hawaii Department of Education. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum right here on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR 1. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Brooke Connor. He's a faculty member over at the UH Manoa and the former CIO over at the Hawaii Department of Education and currently a PhD candidate. And Brooke, we were talking previously before the break about the paper that you presented over at PTC back in January. And you were describing how it seemed like it was the kinds of words being described around AI sounded like very cultish and very sort of hype oriented. And given the fact that we're 7 months since then, and perhaps, I don't want to jump to conclusions, but, there might have been a feeling like it's sort of like a bubble. But the bubble hasn't quite burst yet. But there has been an increased amount of, close kind of critique of the AI business models. There have been quite a bit of really critical analysis of whether these hyperscaler data centers are really what we need. And I would like to ask you, what do you see happening in the short term, based on your observations?
So my observations, I think what is going to happen with this technology, people are going to figure out what it's actually good for and what it's not actually very good for. It's not useful for. And that's something that happens all the time with new technologies. It's a key characteristic of digital transformations and new technologies in general. They get this hype curve and everybody believes it's going to conquer the world and change everything and nothing is going to be as it was before. We heard this about cryptocurrency several years back. Cryptocurrency hasn't disappeared, but it certainly hasn't eroded banks and national currencies and stuff like that. Those are still a thing. They haven't disappeared or anything like that. So I think we're going to see the same kind of thing with AI and large language models. People will realize they're really great for doing things where you don't have a better answer, as long as that thing isn't too complicated. And some of this is just ideas from computer science. Large language models fundamentally are quadratic on the number of inputs that they have. And they have staggering numbers of inputs. So if the problem, though, is simpler than a quadratic calculation on the number of inputs, there's a better way to do it than AI, faster and more efficient. If the problem is more complicated than a quadratic solution, the only way AI is going to get an answer is by being lucky. And so I think people are going to start to figure that out. That's why, despite everybody saying, oh, computer science, nobody needs to learn to program, computer science isn't just learning to program any more than art is just learning how to draw.
Correct.
So people are going to figure out that we need to think about how to really solve problems and recognize when there is a problem we can throw into AI and get a statistical answer that is possibly, probably correct, but is also going to be just built on all the answers we had before.
Mm-hmm.
At the recent PCAT AI summit, and you know, I just heard the sponsor note from PCAT. Yay, PCAT. So I was talking about this, that everybody says, hey, when you talk to AI, AI says it's willing to kill people if they're going to be unplugged. Isn't that scary? And I was like, no, that's Frankenstein. That's Kubrick's 2001.
Mm-hmm.
This is an old story. This is a trope that we've heard before. It's giving us the answers that we've seen before. If you recognize that, then you'll realize, wait a minute, this isn't necessarily doing what we think it does. We think it's thinking. What it's really doing is giving us all of our old stories back to
us. Yeah, exactly. Kind of regurgitating it in a way that we want to perhaps hear it as an answer.
Yes.
Now, Brooke, you know, we only have a couple minutes left, but I did want to ask you, now that you're really fully into the academic and the PhD path, and you said earlier, there's a lot of new things that are potential fodder for your mm-hmm. writing about. So what is top of what is the top of the list that you are quite enamored with and potentially going to spend some research time on?
So part of what I'm spending a lot of time on is how do you describe these complex systems?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key parts is these systems change structurally over time. And in fact, that's something that goes, so this is the heart of my dissertation work, but it also goes back to 30 years ago when I was an academic before, because what I was doing at the time was interactive 3D graphics.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with computer graphics pioneers and figuring out how do you make a complex realistic scene that changes over time. Well, you need to describe it in some sort of language that can describe that well.
Mm-hmm.
And my thinking is that if you can do that well for an organization, a big organization like the Department of Ed, like Morgan Stanley, and figure out how it's going to possibly change, then maybe you can direct it more effectively.
Mm.
And so that's some of what I'm doing. But I'm also realizing that, hey, animation is a great way to learn about computer science, not coding.
Mm-hmm.
Build an animation mm-hmm. and understand the concepts of computer science. And so that's one of the classes I'll be teaching in the fall, and I'm also working on a textbook for that class as well.
So
Brooke, lots of writing, lots of different stuff.
Yeah, no, and it's exciting stuff, and I definitely want to get you back on, and I hope that you have a paper to present over at PTC. Where can people find more information about the work that you're doing, Brooke?
So there's several places. I'll be mentioned on the page for both the computer science department at UH Manoa as well as the CIS PhD program. Both of them have a web page. One mentions me as faculty, one mentions me as a student. The CIS program also has a presence on LinkedIn, and they talk about both the stuff that I do, but also the stuff that all the other students do. And there's some really neat stuff.
Brooke, I'll put that up on
my own LinkedIn.
Yeah, I'll put that up on my show notes later. Brooke is a faculty member of you at UH Manoa, former CIO over at the Department of Education. Hey, Brooke, I want to thank you for joining us today. And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll catch up with sensor company Hohonu. If you miss any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. Our engineer is David Chong. Catch us on HBR One every Friday or anytime via the HBR or your favorite podcast application. In the meantime, you stay safe. You stay awesome. We'll see you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.
Support for Bite Marks Cafe comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.